So hi everybody, breathing meditation, or a visualization, say a few prayers together, and set our motivation. So just get comfortable in your seat, first of all. Try to make sure that your feet are flat on the floor. You check that your back is straight and your shoulders are relaxed. You check to see how your head is actually sitting on your neck. You might like to sort of like raise your shoulders and then bring them down just to sort of check to see how your shoulders are. And when you're ready, you can either keep your eyes open or close them. And place your hands wherever you feel most comfortable. So you feel easy and relaxed in your body. Allow the body to breathe itself. Find some area within the body that it's moving. Which is arising in dependence upon your inhalation and exhalation of breath. And focus your attention there. And while your body continues to breathe itself, and you are focused on the movements that take place, while the process of inhalation and exhalation continues, imagine that the body is becoming more and more relaxed as it breathes normally and naturally. And now that the body is relaxed and the mind is focused, it's very easy to imagine the appearance of all the enlightened beings in the space above you and around you. You think that seated are all sentient beings. You recollect that they wish to be free from suffering and they wish to be happy. And that way they're just like us. Well, we have these two wishes, we continually act in opposition to them. So we find ourselves still suffering and not experiencing genuine happiness. To change the situation for ourselves and for the benefit of others, we need to rely upon something that will help us. So there's something, there's actually three things. They're the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, the three objects of refuge. And fourth thing, which is the mind of enlightenment. So think that you want to bring about enlightenment for yourself for the benefit of others. And to do that, you're going to take refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And then say along with me, I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. So in response to this wish, think that light and nectar pours out of the heart of the Buddha, washes over you and the beings surrounding you, and your potential to become fully awakened. Then recollect the four immeasurable thoughts of compassion, love, joy, and equanimity, and decide to establish all beings in those four boundless states. and say, may all sentient beings have happiness and its causes. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and its causes. May all sentient beings never be separated from the happiness that is without suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from the bias of attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. And again, lights and nectars, pour out the heart of the Buddha, they wash over you and over all beings surrounding you. And the light and nectar reveals these four qualities of mind, being reflections of the mind's nature, effortlessly manifesting. So we feel great compassion, love, joy, and equanimity towards all beings. And we want to establish these four states within your own mental continuum. You recollect the field of merit above you, the field of sense of devotion towards it. And you say, reverently I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginning this time, and rejoice in the merit of all holy ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own and others' merits to the great enlightenment. And to stop any clinging we might have to the merit or to our sense of self, we're going to offer a mandala. So we say together, this ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with mat merit, full of confidence, the sun and the moon. I imagine this as a Buddha field and offer. May all living beings enjoy this pure rain. Idam Guru Rakma Mandala Kamayatayam. We release the mandala, and the Buddha accepts this offering, and he smiles at us, and we look into his eyes. And looking into his eyes, we feel accepted and at ease. And then an emanation leaves the heart of the Buddha, moves through space and comes to abide above the crown of your head, facing in the same direction you are. The emanation descends, entering the crown of your skull and coming down through your body, and stops at the level of your heart. The light of the emanation begins to expand, filling your body and mind with light and nectar. The light and nectar pour out through the pores of your skin, filling the 10 directions of space and establishing every being within space to now be within the enlightened state. And then the lights and nectars begin to withdraw and they re-enter your heart. You can feel yourself breathing normally and naturally, and you know you're seated. You know you've been meditating, and this meditation has been on the level of imagination. And it's imprinted the mind with a cause for your own enlightenment, which will be of benefit to all living beings. You accept that with a sense of joy and gratitude, and then you breathe in deeply through your nostrils and exhale through your mouth, and in your own time allow your body to reawaken, allow your eyes to blink open until you find yourself seated where you are. So today, like I said, this is a review of 8 previous weeks, and in those 8 weeks we looked at the causes for refuge and what the 3 rare sublime ones are, and how to go for refuge to them, the benefits of taking refuge, and finally the refuge ceremony itself. And today we're going to look at, we're going to answer sort of 12 questions. There's two sort of exam papers there. One is like 12 questions for small group discussion, and the other has sort of four questions to be answered in terms of the assessment. So if you want to try and answer these assessment or take part in the small group discussion, like I said, you can have a look at the workbook or up online and you'll see the questions there. We need to try and do, if you try and do this, try and look at it and see what can I answer? Just find the things, just go there, okay, I know that one, I don't know these other ones. And just start like that, just put the ones you actually know. Then sort of have a look at what you don't recollect and see, is there anything I can recollect of it? If there's not, then have a look at the material and gradually sort of build on what you do know. So simply put, find what you do know, refresh the mind with it, and then work out what you don't know. Then go slowly into what you don't know and do like one or two things at a time, no more than that. Once you've read it again, sit there and try and put it into your own words. Some of this material is quite in-depth, there's a lot to think of, but other times it's not. And I prefer you just to get the simplest things and go, this is what refuge is. These other things will take time to learn, a lot of memory involvement and so forth. I've got to associate it with different ways of thinking and so forth. But start with something that you do know. Now, when you, like I said, when you forget the material, you'll find it all in these books here. And this is the material that I've been relying upon. Now, one of the things I'd really like you to take away from this course is this here, what Lama Yeshe says. He says, Westerners should understand that taking refuge is a state of mind. Now, if you can hold on to this idea, then everything else that comes up, you should be looking at them going, oh, so I've got to remember, refuge is a state of mind. How does what I'm looking at reading relate to my state of mind? How does it contribute to me being a refugee? And as he says, it's not enough just to recite the refuge prayer. You have to find the actual meaning of it and then know for yourself that you are taking refuge. So whenever you take refuge, it'll always be in a state of mind. It won't be anything external to that. It's always mind. I just sort of want to make that sort of firm, I guess, or sort of pointed a bit. Otherwise, it's so easy to forget. So when stuff happens to you, like it can't take place independently of mind. It's impossible. So whatever's going on with you, it's got to do with your mind. So you've got to make your own mind the place of your refuge. Now, I'm going to show you some common refuges next. And when you look at this, there is a relationship to the mind here, but probably for most of us, we didn't know that. It's only when you're sort of comfortable to Dharma and studying, actually it all comes back to mind. And until you know that, what it often seems like is your refuge is in something external to you. But you'll see that if you took the mind out of it, you just remove the mind altogether, I mean, you find you wouldn't be able to depend upon these outer objects. There's no way to do it. So here are a number of what we call common refuge objects that we would have all taken refuge in, and some of us are probably still doing it. So here they are. Your parents, family, spouse, or pet. Your parents is often the first one, your mother in particular. So when you were born, you would have been crying a lot. It was a shocking thing to be born and not know what the heck's going on here. And we know what happens if you don't have a mother, if you don't have a caregiver to pick you up and hold you and talk to you. Those people who grow up are really messed up, psychopaths, most of them. And the first object of refuge will be your mother. And you go, what's mum doing? Well, she's holding you, caring, talking softly, all these things, because she knows you're disturbed in some way. So she's imparting love and kindness. But those are mental states. They're expressed through her holding and through her speech. And you're relying upon that to feel safe. And we still do that now, especially with pets. You know? There are a lot of people who may not be in relationships, or even if they are and they're living alone. It's this wonderful thing to have a rat, a cat, a dog, a bird, a fish, something you can come home to and express warmth and kindness towards. Other forms of refuge, like we all go home, right? That's our number one refuge for us. We go home, we have a place to live.
And it's terrible if you don't have a home.
That's right, again. So if you don't have a mother or a home, it's a very hard life. And so we rely upon the home to feel safe, warm, comfortable, all these different things. Now that we're older, most of it's put into, a lot of it's entertainment, isn't it? Most people go home the first thing, or if they wake up in the morning, if you told me about a woman who used to go home, wake up in the morning, first thing she does is turn on television. And it's like, wow, full on. But that's the first thing she does.
Yeah. Just to have voices there.
Yeah, for most of us, the last thing we do at night is turn off the TV. So that's our major refuge, or we're just at home. When we're sick, of course, we rely upon the health system, doctors, nurses. They'll tell us to exercise, to look after ourselves. We rely upon health professionals. Of course, we always need food, and one of the things we have is what we call comfort food. So if you're not really aware, it might be quite shocking to you how many times you just go through the fridge when you're at home. Okay. And of course, you know, all of these things, alcohol, sex and drugs, religion and philosophy, your job, hobbies, politics, power and wealth is another one, very strong forms of refuge. So we seek, you know, sort of sense of safety in these objects. But if you sort of think a little bit about it, you'll see that it's not just the object, it's how the mind relates to the object. Like I said, if you took the mind out of the picture altogether, how do these provide refuge for you? Well, I wouldn't do. Right? But as soon as you put the mind in, now it's like you either like these things, there's something beneficial about them. And most times what you think, it's the object themselves. So you want the objects. But it's actually the relationship of the mind to the object. And what you'll often find is that all of these objects of refuge only provide a temporary refuge. And at the very same time they provide a temporary refuge, they can also not do that. You know, so we know many, many people we know who took refuge in their mother and father, of course, as first object of refuge, and they found pretty quickly that they weren't a reliable object of refuge. That's what I'm saying. It's like they don't always provide us what we seek. In fact, me, you know, turn against you, can work against you. So you find over time that these objects of refuge are unreliable, and often what we do is we blame the objects. It's their fault. We go on a relationship of the mind to the object. Yes, Ben?
I'm a little bit confused about the analytics.
Yep, so here, so you might think, like I've had an experience here where a woman came from a Buddhist country and she saw the Buddha as like God, external to her. So that's not very useful. And it wasn't useful for her when her daughter committed suicide. It's So it's like I said, it's the relationship of the mind to these objects. So you can have philosophies that don't actually work.
But that's not something. Doesn't
have all. No, it's not. No, we're not saying it's all. Like I said before, it can be just as useful to you temporarily, but it can also work against you. You know, if you relate to it in a mistaken fashion, now you've got a problem, haven't you? It really comes back to the relationship of the mind to the object. If you just thought as soon as you said that, Ben, I thought, well, we've got to bring into this thing and go, well, sometimes, because the idea that the dog of a tooth was actually the relic of the Buddha's tooth, even though they're completely mistaken about it, was very useful.
Yeah.
But then you go, so what's the thing here? Is it the object or the mind?
And people come here to this building, to Lumbee Tonga Centre, for some peace. And it's not
that's
the
right.
building,
and
it's temporary, but it's a connector to some peace in the mind.
Yeah, that's right. But to rely upon that as the refuge, you're making a mistake. So again, so you come back as I say, one of the major things, remember that resters should understand that taking refuge is a state of mind. So just as I was coming up, I thought, I should really emphasize this, because what we can do with that knowledge is then look at all the objects and go, so how's my mind relating to this? Is it providing refuge or not? See, I think it's in the Dhammapada, isn't it? So it starts off by saying that mind is foremost. It starts off talking about the massive importance of the mind. And then saying that if the mind goes along this way, then it'll produce all the suffering for you. But if it goes along this way, it can produce all this happiness for you. So it's important to keep, you've got to keep coming back to the mind, to your own mind. And ask yourself, how am I relating to these objects? And so here's our next set. So we've got all this, but then again, there's this, what they call refuge in the eight worldly concerns. So again, here we're looking at, so how is my mind relating to these objects? In one, I'm seeking delight, and in the other, I'm trying to avoid displeasure. So here's so. One, we're going to go for delight in comfort and pleasure. So you look at the things. Here we've got chocolate cake. But you can take any physical object, any object that you can relate to with your senses. And, you know, you'd much prefer to feel comfortable or pleasurable, wouldn't you, than to feel discomfort, uncomfortable, unpleasant feelings. And so you want to avoid the unpleasant feelings. We just want to have the pleasant feelings. So we've got to find objects that will do that. But these objects, I says, are unreliable. Because if you eat too much chocolate cake, you get sick. And there's great use in feeling uncomfortable. In fact, if you want to learn, you need to sort of work up to a level of discomfort. And go through it.
Well, actually, even our pain system, it's crucial.
Yeah, that's right. We have a pain system. It's crucial that when it hurts, we actually know it hurts. Otherwise, we lose an arm or a leg, right? Because we don't know. Actually, this thing is telling us something meaningful and useful. Well, I remember the story. So the story of one of the teachers was sitting there giving a lesson. He didn't understand or didn't feel his foot had actually gone to sleep. When he got off here, broke his leg. So pain is a very useful thing. So you can see it's highly dependent, but what's going on here is we're going to extremes. One extreme of attachment and the other extreme of aversion. We're saying, I don't want anything I feel averse to, I want everything I feel attractive towards. That'll make me happy. But in fact, that's not the case. So most of us, you know, we want to gain things, we like to acquire things, we want to make a profit in some way. And we can have, like I said, attachment, overestimate the goodness of it.
It's funny because, like today, I gained all these books, but I got way less money.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yes, it was funny. So just after we bought them, I just think about, like, who are we going to leave them to when we die?
I thought about that. I'm leaving it to my school.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, we seek praise, admiration, approval, but we don't want to have any criticism or blame. Often, yeah, we have uncomfortable feelings when we're criticised or we're blamed for things, and we don't like it. But there could be some value in it. Because the feelings are uncomfortable, we don't get the value.
I find this one really challenging around approval.
Oh, for sure.
Like, you want to be forward with a nice person.
That's right. It's a good person, a nice person. That's right. That's right. And you're fired up for how reactive you are when that's not how others approach you or say, boy, it just flies up, doesn't it, really quick. Ben, you got your hand raised, or you?
I was just thinking of this material. None of them seem to be that problematic if you don't grasp it.
Yeah, that's right. They're not a problem if you grasp.
If you don't grasp.
If you don't grasp, it's not a problem. If you don't grasp or cling to them, no, it's not a problem. If you know they're impermanent, insubstantial or empty, not a problem.
Yeah, so we just put way more store on them than they can handle.
That's right. And the most common thing for a non-Buddhist person is to think these are the things that are the problems, not the clinging or the grasping, right, which is coming from our side. That's the root of all the problems. So you can see the Buddha Dharma is like flipping it on its head. It's going, no, the problems out there aren't there, the good stuff's out there, it is your mind. Refuge is a state of mind.
They say Buddhist is an inner being because it's changing that.
So we talked about the Buddhist being an inner being, so they turn away from this process of going outside to relieve themselves of their suffering and to provide more happiness. So they stay within the folds of the Buddhist teaching and know actually what's the real source of happiness and unhappiness is the mind itself. So these outer objects are not objects of refuge for me. So for most of us, how we can make use of this is you just look back over your life and see where you've put your refuge in these things and found it like it doesn't work. Anyone who's drank too much alcohol, started off feeling good, just knows it's like, it's terrible, isn't it? So I was coming home on the bus the other day, and I saw this, I went straight ahead, I went, oh, no, there's something on the seat, so I sat there, and I'm sitting there, and suddenly I can smell it, and it's like it's all vomit all over the bus seat, and I look at the floor, like that even might be urine on the floor, right? And I go, somebody overdid it, trying to be happy, and this is the result. And of course, this is another one, as you put out, Ian, this thing of like we really love admiration and approval and we want to have a good reputation. And for most of us think, well, there's nothing wrong with a good reputation. How could that work against us? But in fact, it could do. Usually, it's all it takes is somebody to be jealous of you, work against you.
Or to be defamed by AI. And everyone can still know it's not true, but it's still out there.
That's right.
Falsity.
Yeah.
Even other people will try to manipulate you too to get your support by building your reputation. Then probably doing the wrong one.
Like I said, if you just take something and go down each side, and challenge each of these things. Then you work out very quickly, yep, I've gone through this, that was not the case. Anybody who's had a marriage that's failed or had a romantic breakup should know this. You made a mistake. You thought this was the person. It's not personally the fault. You made a mistake. You thought this person was going to be the one that make you happy. But That's not possible. They can contribute to your happiness, but the major cause of your happiness is your own mind. How do you relate to the other person? Yeah. So oftentimes, so Ben has asked a question here about causes and conditions. So the primary cause, the major cause of your own happiness or suffering is your mind. And then you can talk about other main causes and so forth, but basically you can just go, they're all conditions. But mind itself is conditioned. So of all the conditions that are necessary for happiness, the major condition, major cause, is the mind. Other things contribute. And even some of those mental factors contribute. So what are we seeking refuge from, and what can contribute to us taking that refuge? Now, so I remember when I was much younger, so, and as most of us would probably do, up to a point. So, like you go to school, so you see a girl, ooh, I like her. Not even thinking, just feels this way, right? So she's going to be my girlfriend, the one that's, I feel this really good feeling towards her, so why I want her to be my girlfriend. So anybody who's done this in school will know how heartbreaking this is, right? So what do I think? She's nice. She does these things. All that's got to happen is but like for me, I didn't realize this nice girl was so shy. And so she couldn't return my affection because of her shyness. And I misunderstood that to be something else. So very quickly, this wasn't a nice girl. I thought I would, profit by having this relationship. It was so hard to have the relationship. It just hurt all the time. So my decision from there was, I'm not having anything more to do with girls, right? Because you can see, isn't it? They're the ones, right? So draw the wrong conclusion twice. They're going to make me happy. Oh, they're not. They're going to actually hurt me. No, I don't want nothing to do with them now. And that's like not just her, but everyone, all of them. Yeah, that's right. It's extreme way, but this is—it's just what do you call it? On the spectrum of extremes, isn't it?
Yeah, because we can jump around from one to the other. We can distract ourselves from that. It doesn't become apparent. It's only when we get stuck in a situation that it becomes apparent that it's a problem. Because if we're not getting enough success, then we just go and eat comfort food, or we try and get more money or whatever it is,
but
just jump around on those things.
Like I said, just use this and have a look at your life, and see where you've made your own mistakes, where you've made your own things and they don't work out, and go, well, I have to have played a part of that. And my own mind has to have played a part of that. I've misapprehended what those objects can actually do and what my mind is actually doing. But most of us growing up, we would have left the mind out of the picture altogether. We would have just thought it's the objects. Yeah, it's overestimation going on here, and underestimation too, but both sides. So as this little, as that young kid growing up, right? So I make this mistake thinking actually, girls aren't the source of my happiness, they're the source of every problem I'll ever face, and I don't want to ever feel hurt like that again. So what am I going to do? What do you think?
Avoid girls,
right? They're dangerous. They're going to hurt me. That's what we've got to do to become Buddhist refugees, but not towards girls. It's towards this type of thinking. This type of thinking is really dangerous. Is what happened to me, of course, you grew up in your 20s, and I did that when I was about 11, right? So it's 10 years of thinking this and very wary of, you know, you don't, can't trust my mother either. She's a girl, woman. But then you find, you can't trust them. Yeah. So it just reinforces this wrong belief. So then you get into your 20s and you're the only guy that doesn't have a girlfriend and you are lonely. Right? Now what? You still want to be happy. You know, gee, loneliness feels terrible. But it's terrible when you're with these women. Right? What to do? So when we come to seek refuge, that's one of the things that's got to drive our refuge, an awareness of danger. But it's like, you know, don't make the mistake and think it's a dangerous woman. That's your problem, right?
The danger happening in our mind.
That's right. It's a dangerous way of thinking and the results that thinking brings. So it's not just inner what it does out here. It works on how you are in the world, because we're not separate from the world, are we? So there's an awareness of danger. And then finally, when I got to change my mind, you know, which I did, of course, luckily, you have a sense of conviction or faith that now you're on the right track. Because you're not suffering, you're not as lonely as you used to be. But you can actually have a relationship with someone. And luckily for me, my major relationship was one driven by compassion. And it worked for a long time. So awareness of danger. So when we first come into the Buddha Dharma, this awareness is like a sense of fear, alarm or dread. So you're fearful, right? But then in terms of the other side, a sense of confidence or trust.
Yeah, but it's not enough just to have the dread, because that's like the existential angst, and then what?
That's right. Like I said, for me, all of this, you're just growing up really lonely and started wondering if you might be a psychopathic sort of person, because you seem to be more and more separated off from people. You know, like from my side, no, you can't trust the women, but the guys, they're so competitive and brutal too. It's like, whoa, you don't want to have too much to do with them either. Right? Now you're just alone with your thoughts. Yeah. And lastly, is this compassion. So compassion towards yourself is really important. That's why you mainly taking refuge. Right? You want to put an end to your own suffering. And you've got to find a way to do that and feel confident about it. And the way you feel confident about it is because it actually works. But you discover pretty much, wow, I'm not suffering as much as I did before. Well, that's better. How do these three here, remembering refuge is a state of mind. So as Buddhist practitioners, we're looking, you know, the world was introduced to us through the lens of the Buddha, and he tells us basically that anything that's produced in this world is impermanent, is subject to change. There's no stability here. Objects lack a self-identity. They have no solidness, and you can see that through the impermanence, but it also introduces you to what they call selflessness or emptiness. And you suffer in all this. It's not like there's no suffering there. It's suffering takes place. And it fluctuates. Yeah, but it's always going on. Especially for us as unenlightened beings. It's just rooted in suffering. Like for me, it's like, you know, you don't know what's going on. You thought you did. You thought, oh, it's like this, but I was wrong. Then all the suffering follows. So there's just like my example is a sort of extreme example, but if you look back at your own lives too, you'll find the same things happening. You're wrong about a lot of things. But you think you're right. And you're acting as if you're right. And it's not working out. So what's to blame? Well, if you don't come back at yourself and ask some questions of yourself, you've got to think it's the object, don't you? So in terms of Buddhist refuge, in terms of the small, you know, we go, well, what is certain about this lack of substantiality and impermanence is death is certain. That's one thing it is. There's nobody here that was born 1,000 years ago and is still here. And in fact, you can see your brothers and sisters and close friends die. And you can have your pets and they will die. And you will know, I'm going to die too. So you might think, oh, then there's nothing to worry about because that's the end. But it might not be. And if there's something else, like what? You know, so most of us would have grown up in a Christian culture, you go, well, there's hell. After death is hell or heaven. And you might just go, well, I don't believe in that, so, but you know, does that mean it doesn't exist? Hell no.
And does that mean that we're not scared of death?
Yeah. So from Buddhism, they say, no, there's other lives that will take place, and some of them will be very good and some will be very bad. So which is it you want? So introduce us to the concept of the lower realms. And like a terrible places to be reborn, and the suffering's immense compared to what the sufferings we experience here. So you have to, so that's the idea, you go, well, that's what I don't want. I don't want that to happen to me. And so you have alarm at that prospect. And you'll see, if you think about it a little, you can find out, wow, that's been going on all of my life. You know, whenever I had a sort of a decision that was sort of dangerous, you sort of evaluate it, don't you? And go, yeah, I don't know. Like, you know, look what might happen. I don't think so, not for me. And then your mates might go ahead and do it, and the car crashes. You know, they went out to the pub and you stayed home. Someone got drunk and the car rolled over. Yeah. You're at a party, they said, try this, mate. It's some sort of drug that you've never heard of before. What does it do? And they say, oh, I don't know. Come on, try, it's really good, you know. I'll just see what happens. And then somebody overdoses or dies. You know, because you've got this sort of wariness about it, isn't it? You go, hey, I don't know. So sometimes when you don't know, you go, oh, it doesn't matter. I'll give it a shot. But some people go, because I don't know, I'm not going there yet. I'll just see what happens, right?
I'll hedge my bets.
So I'll just see what happens. And if something terrible happens, you go, oh, thank God I didn't do it. And that's the great danger. You know, so I'm not going to do it. So this is like this. You look ahead. And you see, this could be the result. I don't want that result. And because you didn't do it, you have some conviction that you're right. You weren't in the car when it crashed. You weren't the person who overdosed. Why? Because you said no. That was a good choice. You're convinced you made the right choice. Yeah. Now, why did you do that? Because you had some compassion for yourself. You're thinking about your future. You're thinking about your future and whether it would be, you didn't want to suffer the car crash, the overdose, the fact that your drink was spiked and you found yourself raped. You don't want that stuff. And it didn't happen to you because you didn't take that drink from the stranger, or you kept an eye on the glass on the bar, or you didn't go in the car, you didn't take the drug. That's compassion. That's compassion expressed towards yourself. We call that renunciation in Buddhism. You can sort of see ahead to danger. You go, nah, that might really hurt my life and my life of my parents and people who care for me. I'm not going to do that. So here, the Buddha Dharma is a very similar type thing. You're looking ahead, you know for certainty death is going to happen. You ask yourself, what might happen after death? You're introduced to a teaching that says it could be really bad or it could be very good. You have to decide out of your sense of compassion for yourself, oh, I don't want very bad. Right? Oh, what do I have to do to avoid the very bad? And you're introduced to the techniques for doing it. Now here when you see this, you know, the capacity of the refuge seeker, the first person of the small scope is seeking a good rebirth and happiness within cyclic existence. You say, well, where's the best place for that to go? Right where you are right now. The human being that can come into contact with the teachings of the Buddha and have a teacher, be interested in this, and keep working on your spiritual path. Because it doesn't matter how many times you find yourself in this good situation, you will always die. You'll always be disappointed. You'll always get sick. You're always going to meet up with problems. But the problems here are much better than the problems elsewhere. But here, you can work with them. Why? Human mind. With this body and this mind, you're in the best position possible. So after, you know, don't take you too long. Take even just one lifetime. If you get introduced to this and you think about it, you think, man, I want to be free of this crap. That's liberation. So if you grew up in the 60s or 70s, you would have known about freedom. You know, and people are still seeking freedom all over the world. But very few are seeking freedom from this continual cycle of what we call samsara. Suffering that goes round and round and round, just repeating itself. If you think it through, you go, that's what I want. But with a little more thinking through, you go, everyone will want that. Everyone wants that. Yeah, and you have relationships with people you care for and who care for you. And so what? You're just going to go for yourself? So again, you work out, no, it's better that I do this for everyone, that I can help everyone get out. So this is when you take refuge in the great scope. You know, you recognize, just as I care about my own suffering and wish to put an end to it, everybody else is suffering too. What's the difference between me and them? Yeah, well, none, other than the fact there's more of them than there is of me. I'm just one single person, but others are numberless. That's the difference. So we have these different levels of refuge. And like I said, the first one is to come into realizing I'm going to die. That's a certainty. And after death, I'm unsure of what's going to happen. Is there anything I can do about my uncertain future? And the answer, of course, is yes. Yes, there is. And those of you, you know, you see in the precepts, first, don't willingly take the lives of other beings. Don't kill them. Don't steal from them. Don't get engaged in sexual misconduct, or don't have relationships with other people who are in relationships, or when you're in one, because it hurts people. You get caught here, or even if you don't get caught, it hurts. So don't do it. So, you know, we withhold certain types of behavior, and then we can be assured we're not going to end up in the lower realms at the time of death. So just back off a bit, something we can do. But if we wish to seek liberation from cyclic existence altogether, we have to do a bit more. So we've got to look at the actions that we're doing, like killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, harsh speech and so forth, and go, so what's causing that? I've got to stop the causes of those behaviours. If I can stop the causes, there's no way I can come back into this cycle. And if I wish to take refuge in the great capacity, the great scope, not only do I need to do that, but I've actually got to do it for others. Yeah, and what stops me doing it for others is just self-concern, just my own concern, just for me. And what I found is a lovely way to put it is like to have a go at that, is just ask yourself, so all my life I've been concerned about me, and where's it got me? Well, look, I'm right here. I'm still in this office, right? He goes, well, that hasn't worked out too well.
We can visit somebody in hospital, you can be all miserable, and then you get to the hospital and just seeing all the other people works off. It just puts it in perspective.
Yep, that's right.
You don't even have to kind of think about it, it just becomes apparent.
So when we take refuge then, like the Miffy's pointed out, this apparent suffering of others, there's a sense of relief. That's the first thing you do. Oh, it's like, at last, I'm on my way. As I just said, I remember the song, the Proclaimer singing, I'm on my way, I'm on my way to happiness. It's a great song. You get a sense of relief. It's like, at long last, I found out what to do. And what you know what to do is what to stop doing and why. That's the most important thing for me. It's like, yeah, you can tell me not to steal, but like, why? It's like, you know, if I steal it, I'm successful. I've got it. Yeah, that's right. Convince me. So we're convinced, right? We convince ourselves. This is what not to do, and we know what to do. So that is the start of taming the mind. And we just start, now we've got something we can actually work with. And from that, a mind that is tameable is a source of all of, well, it's a source of freedom, basically. You work out, you know, like when you think about like training a horse, you know, so before you train the horse, you've got to tame the horse. Once the horse is tamed, then you can train it. So it's the same here with when we take refuge, right? We tame ourselves by working on our behavior, first of all, like no killing, stealing, sexual misconduct. Tame the speech. Then you can train it. You can be speaking respectfully, kindly, training the face to smile when you see other people. So now I've got something workable. And in terms of this, our tradition, what we've got to tame the mind is to tame it in the sense that we don't have so much self-concern. The concern is for other. And you get all the benefits anyway, except more so. So, look, how is this coming about? Well, we are trusting an institution or a method or a person to help us through a crisis and deliver us to a more favorable outcome. So in terms of just this life suddenly becomes meaningful and valuable. But so at one stage, I never cared about dying. I was quite willing to go up against lots of things because I didn't care. Now I'm nearly 17, now I'm really caring. It's like, oh man, I wish I could do more. My life's nearly over. Like, I want to have a long life. I've got so much to do. So it's really changed. But from first of all, not caring, and then in that sense of not caring, just caring about me, actually. And then suddenly it switches. And then suddenly you find, wow, what you've actually got, what you can do with it. So to take this refuge, we have what we need things to help us, or causes to become an authentic refugee. And the first one is you want to have a teacher. So for us, the causal object of refuge is our own teacher, the Buddha. We rely upon the scriptures and realizations that they direct us towards, guide us towards, and we need a community of other people who are just like us. So I remember when I was younger, and I know this is the case still to be the case. Now, if you ever want to get away from an addiction, if you want to drop an addiction, one of the things you need to do is move away from people who have the same addiction as you. You've got to find a different peer group who are interested in the same things you are. So you might find yourself in a Dharma center like
that's
this.
That's a really good good example, because you can put in all that effort, but if you're hanging around with everybody that has no interest in the Dharma and just wants to,
yeah, they're doing the same things as used to.
Night, it's hard.
It's really hard. Yeah, they'll come over stoned, drunk, or smoking, or whatever, you know, doing the same things you're doing. They're going to call you, you know, they're your friend.
Well,
if you really ask
I
about it.
Took up smoking again, it was just through just living with people that smoked.
Right, that's right.
And then you have to give up all over again, and then
yeah,
how
it's
many
hard.
Times did that happen?
Yeah, so we take refuge, or we depend upon a community of people with like-minded interests. So our path becomes easier. We find out what actually works for us. So most of us, you'll find yourself sitting in rooms like this, listening to someone like myself or someone else, or you're reading books and you're thinking about it, or you're watching films and you're trying to relate the film to what you've read and thought about. And of course, you need a teacher. It's not enough just to read books and think on your own. You'll need someone to challenge your thoughts, to help you when times get difficult. So when we're taking refuge in the three rare sublime ones, our pledge is that we accept the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha as the safest direction to go to be freed from suffering and the obscurations that follow. Now, our next part is the hard part, right? So this part that just came, I would consider the easy part. So it may not be so easy for you, but there's some things in it you could remember, you know, like thinking, so what did Lama Yeshe say about what refuge was? It's a state of mind, right? So you go, okay, so that's what I've got to remember. Refuge is a state of mind. Okay, and what have I taken refuge in before? Yeah, well, mum and dad, you know, money, wealth, a job, a house, food, TV, all those things. Are those things states of mind? They're not. Well, that's not actual refuge. Do they actually provide the refuge I sought? No. Sometimes, temporarily, yeah, life was a bit better, but then, no, it wasn't reliable. And what am I seeking refuge from? Yeah, this is another state of mind. So it all comes back to the mind. And you say, well, how am I going to work with my mind? Yeah, so, well, I could take refuge in what? So this is how I'm talking to you. This is how you need to talk to yourself, right? Because this is what we've just done. Like I said, it's the easy bit. It's something you can all understand. So you'd be able to talk to yourself and say, well, okay, how do I go with that? You could, well, pretty good, I think. Or I'll go up online and have a look at the PDF and see if I covered, how much have I covered? Yeah, I covered most of it. Then go, okay. Now, suppose if you have a child, think that one of your children comes and says, Daddy, what's refuge mean? See if you can explain it to them. Because if you can, you're well on your way to knowing what refuge is. So I think take that, work with that. You've got to have that part, like the easy bit. And now we come to the hard bit. You go, well, the hard bit, that's going to take more time. But that's all it's going to take.
It's going to take us 30 minutes.
More time. And it's up to me to work out, like, you know, to ask some questions about this stuff. Like one of the major questions will come up for you. I just saw this today, reading about how we learn and really great ways of learning. And this guy said, you know what you want to know, ask yourself first is, what's the concept? So the concept is like, what is Buddha? What do you mean by Dharma? We didn't just ask those questions. We're asking about the concept. What is this thing you're talking about? So you want that first. That's the most important thing. Then you can go off and maybe go, so what are the qualities of this Buddha? What are the qualities of Dharma? What's it meant to do? You know, you ask these questions and then a little more detail. But find the major thing first. So you all know the major concepts are Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Three rare sublime ones. You might ask, okay, so Buddha, like what is that? So have the Buddha jewel, right? So it's defined to be like this. A Buddha jewel is an ultimate object of refuge. It has eight excellent qualities, such as uncreated and so forth. Now that's the concept of Buddha, what the jewel is, defined it. Right? So if you look at that, you go, do I understand what that means? And probably you go, no, I don't know what the heck that means. Like, why is it called, for instance, a jewel? What is an ultimate object of refuge? What is that? And it says it's got eight excellent qualities, such as uncreated and so forth. You're uncreated. Uncreated. What's that? So you've got like two or three questions here. And you go, do I know the answers? You go, no. You go, great. I don't know that. I just put that aside. But I want to find out. Because over here I know, but this I don't know. And I'll come back, but I don't know now. So you start going like, so what might be the most interesting one here, or easiest? You might think it's the jewel that's the easy one, or uncreated. Which one is it? Just no matter, find them, start going into it, look into it. And more questions will arise. So this way for going for refuge is you find out what these objects are, and so first we'll find out what these good qualities are. So uncreated is one of the qualities. The jewel has a heap of the qualities in it. It's got eight in there as well. And what makes it different than the other objects of refuge? What distinguishes it? Not only from the other objects of refuge, but other objects of refuge. What makes this one a one? And then other questions. So how do I commit myself to this object of refuge, this jewel? And what am I not going to do? Yeah. So you can just sort of see, and you look at this and go, okay, so, well, I look at this and go, okay. No, I don't recollect the definition of Buddha jewel, but I could. It's an alternate object of refuge, which has eight excellent qualities, such as uncreated and so forth. Right? But you could do that, but you'll see that you'll need to, it's memory, isn't it? You have to repeat it a few times, break it up into phrases. Then go, what's a jewel? What's uncreated and so forth, so you know. Okay. But then when it comes to look at the whole thing, I know I've got to do four things. I want to know what are the qualities of Buddha so that I find that they're a reliable object of refuge. What makes them different than anything else? You can see here there's four things I've got to go through. I need to know the qualities of the object of refuge. I need to know what distinguishes it from the other objects of refuge and from any other object of refuge. Because why should I take refuge in Jesus or Muhammad? Why should it be Buddha? And then we'll go, okay, and then, you know, once I say this, how do I express my commitment to this? Because remember, refuge is mind. So this is the thing. So don't forget that. Otherwise, it seems like, wow, what am I talking about now? Like this Buddha thing, what the heck's that? So you got to keep coming, like, it's mind. Buddha has to do with mind. Dharma has to do with mind. Sangha has to do with mind. Ramayishi said, Westerners should understand that refuge is a state of mind. So all this has to come back to mind, a state of mind. Different states of mind that protect me in different ways. One from the suffering of the lower realms, one from suffering while I'm in samsara, and one from my self-concern, where I'm just concerned about me and I forget about others. And if I can do this, they say, so refuge must be a fearless state of mind. It must be a mind that's very skillful. It's compassionate. And it's pleased with practice. It's always, you've got to, you know, like I said, keep coming back, making it personal to yourself. So now we come to, like, you know, actually going into these three, these different jewels, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And so here we can say, you know, what is its defining characteristic? Well, it's a mind or a person who is fully enlightened. So if you are the person who's fully enlightened, your mind has the quality of enlightenment. And what would you do if you're fully enlightened? Well, you would help others. That's what a Buddha does. And how does the Buddha help? Through teaching. Which is devotion, they are objects of offering and service. So you can see here in terms of the mind, what do you think, what mental qualities are related to this?
Generosity and humility.
That's right. So there's two straight away. There we go again. That's mind. So the Buddha is a role model we emulate. So you see that there's all these good qualities of mind, of course, speech and behaviors. But it's rooted in mind. So we recollect that. In terms of the merit, this is here, generating merit. You have to sort of look at this and see how it relates to the Buddha and to other objects. So you accept the Buddha as the ideal teacher of refuge. And you refuse other teachers or systems as an ultimate refuge. Now again, so you know, we have this idea of the Buddha, right? So we've got Buddha dual, we've got historical Buddha, and we've got Buddha nature. And we've got to relate all this to the mind itself. So for some of you might read that great story where they say, if you see the Buddha on the road, kill him. Because that object on the road is not your mind. Remember, you've got to come back to the mind. So when they say it, it's really interesting, isn't it? And you go, what? You think, yeah, you think Buddha's out there, don't you? Right? Now, Buddha's mind. And what he's saying is kill the conception that there is a Buddha out there that's going to help you. Put an end to your suffering. So that's what the idea behind this is. You're killing the person of the Buddha, you're killing the conception, destroying the idea. So here we have the Buddha, right? Then we come to, and we do this through each of these ones. We go to the Dharma Jewel, we find the definition, we go, it is a truth of complete purification. So the first question I ask is like, what is truth? What do you mean by truth? So, but have a look at that, okay, complete purification. Complete purification. In the continuum of an aria, you go, well, what is aria? You might say, what do you mean by continuum? Simply put, it's the mind. We have a mind that is completely pure. Within the body of a person, the aria is the person. And this aria is endowed with any of the eight qualities, such as inconceivable. So what's inconceivable, you might say? Inconceivable by conceptual mind, inconceivable through language. You can't quite get at it through language. Thought won't deliver it as it is. So you can see again, you know, if you're really interested in this, which we should be, because we're taking refuge, right? We're entrusting our mind to the Dharma. And again, you can see, well, what's its distinctive characteristic, right? Well, it's a result of enlightenment, the Buddha's enlightenment. Its activity is to have abandoned suffering or abandoning it and its causes. So here again, we come back to the mind. The mind is actually putting an end to the suffering it's created. And you've got to devote yourself to this. No one else can do this for us. We have to do it.
You can't outsource it.
Yeah, this is right. It's just like we don't outsource our hunger, do we? We say, Ben, I would like you to eat all that lovely food. I'll feel so much better. I'll work harder tonight. The practice, of course, is to generate what they call these true paths. So you find the method, and you start becoming familiar with it. And the method here they talk about is wisdom, wisdom realizing emptiness. So how to do that? How do you realize that? How do you put it, how do you work it? And the Dharma does bring good results. You know, you can discover this in your lifetime while you live. You, if you work what causes suffering and you stop doing it, you feel better straight away. Life gets better. Right? And the great, this is the field of merit, is our own mind stream. We come to the Sangha jewel then. It's the same thing again. We have a, we define it, then we look at this definition and go, what's it mean? So here it's a person, an Arya person. So an Arya is someone who has realized emptiness. They've directly got it the way things are. I've seen it directly. So you go, okay, so somebody's done that, it's a person, and they're possessing in their mind stream any of the eight qualities of knowledge and liberation. Because the wisdom of realizing emptiness is the means to bring about the freedom and the liberation. That's what it does. Like I said, it takes away wrong views. Wrong ideas are destroyed. And it's the wrong ideas that are creating the suffering. So for me, like when I was, had this idea that it was women that were the problem, so then I find that actually when I start to actually care for another woman out of compassion for her, my suffering decreases immensely. You know, oh my gosh, I'm happier.
How come?
How come? Wow, it's like this tree. Yeah. So you have a sense of liberation. You're liberated from that wrong idea that women could be the cause of all your problems. And there's a sense of freedom that comes about. Now you can start relating to women in a completely different way. And then we have the Sangha jewel, right? So they practice correctly through personal instruction. So I remember when I first came, when I met my first Buddhist monk, the thing, one of the first things he said to me, that was the third thing he said. We were at class and we'd just done a meditation and he asked us, what do you think is more important, your personal experience or meditation? And I went, personal experience, that's what's got me here. And he didn't say anything, you know, which made me think about my answer. So I went away and thought about my answer, and then I thought about what I had to go through in terms of personal experience to get to that meditation session, where other people had got to it through meditation and a lot less suffering than I went through. No, oh my God.
Yeah, I relate to that. You don't have to go out and do everything to know, oh, it's not a good idea doing that.
That's
you can
right.
Just extrapolate it out by sitting and thinking about it.
That's right. Yeah. So it's like, and you know, later on I read it was probably one of the worst ways, but it's a very effective way of learning what not to do if you get yourself in trouble first. So correct practice through personal instruction, and then to take joy in practicing these teachings. That's the activity. So in terms of this enlightened activity, so there's a nun that just passed away recently, this nun, long-term nun in the FPMT. If you read her bio online, and that's to take joy in practicing the teachings, that's what she exhibited. Very, very hard being one of the original nuns in the FPMT. But, oh man, the difficulty she went through, and she just kept the joy up. And yeah, she was in harmony with the teachings. She practiced correctly. She was always asking Rinpoche for advice, and then she followed the advice. She did that too, fostered enthusiasm. You got to recollect that you are the support for others and for your own practice. And there's more merit supporting them than there is in a statue of the Buddha, for instance. Now, all of this is to bring us to the resultant refuge, right? States of mind. Was remember at the beginning? Refuge is a state of mind. So Buddha potential, that is the innate potential of the mind. to completely be purified and fully flourishing with all good qualities. That's the potential of the mind. So also I think, you know, people have been doing this ever since the Buddha did this. It's not like something new. It's not we have to reinvent all the ways of to do it. It's been done. Probably just not by us. We're the newbies. And like I said, the actual result of stage is these true paths, especially the true cessations. Because remember that these true cessations are absences. Like I said before, there's the absence of incorrect ways of thinking. It's not there anymore. So they can't produce the suffering. And you know, you've got to find a way to do that. That's the true path. And this leaves you with all the good qualities of the mind. So you actually have refuge. Your mind is only, there's no way you can suffer. And so there are many, many benefits of taking refuge, of being an authentic refugee and taking refuge in the three rare sublime ones. And so here are eight of them from the oral tradition. So you are a Buddhist. Meaning now you are an inner being. You are included in the teachings that bring freedom from suffering and the flourishing of all good mental qualities. You hold this vow to develop your mind, because you know that's the source of happiness and it's also the source of suffering. You want to put an end to suffering, have good qualities, great for yourself, good for others. You can stop these bad habitual patterns that we sort of do unconsciously. You have a last store of energy. You avoid miserable realms of rebirth. You don't be thwarted in your goal. This is the thing, if you realize that no matter where you go, your mind will always be with you. So your happiness and your suffering depends upon how you work with your mind. It doesn't matter if there's nobody around you or when you're in the company of everybody. You still have your mind. Now, so there have been plenty of people who have not had the company of anybody and they kill themselves. There's been many people who have no company of others and they're pretty, really happy. Like, so what's the go here?
Trying to get water to not have company in their mind.
Yeah, that's right. That's another thing that happens. Yeah. So when you realize this, it's like, you know, in a way, it's sort of, I guess you'd call it renunciation. You just give up on a whole lot of other things and go, it's up to me. It's up to me. And it's always been up to me. It's always been up to us. But we just didn't sort of know it really. And a lot of people don't know that. They still think it's up to others. Something else has got to happen, then I'll be happy. That's not true. You can accomplish everything you wish for and achieve Buddhahood. So the measure of having gone for refuge, if you have taken refuge, you have deep confidence in the objects of refuge. So, so give me an example of that, somebody. I can go, Ben, and you go, not me. There's three of us here. Look around at someone else. Everybody look at some Ben. Yeah, that's right. So if you ask us, say, well, okay, so there is this deep confidence in the objects of refuge. The objects of refuge are Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Deep confidence in them. What can I have deep confidence in Buddha? So when you first begin, you can say, and for me, it's like, I had deep confidence somebody has done it. Somebody did it. As soon as I think somebody did it, I know I'm talking about a human being here, then I go, then I'm a human being. Then I can do it. You got a why. You got it's the nature of the mind. A deep confidence in this, in that knowledge. mind does not inherently exist. All the delusions don't truly exist, none of it. Mind is not a physical entity. Mind is change. It's clear light, all those sort of things. You go, yeah, I have confidence in that. Dharma. What do you have confidence in the Dharma? One thing you could quickly say is, well, I've put an end to some of my problems, you know. I don't have all the problems I used to have when I was 11, 12, 13, 14. How did I do that? And it's not that somebody told you stuff, and they might have, but then you had to do it. You had to think something, you had to change your way of thinking. If you've ever done that and suffered less or don't suffer that anymore, you just put into practice Dharma. You should know, oh heck, I've done that. I did that.
Would part of having a measure of God for refuge be that when things go wrong, seeking a Dharma solution is like your first thought rather than the last one?
Well, you would have, isn't it? Because, you know, if any problem that arises, you go, the problems don't exist separate from the mind. My mind is related to this term problem. I mean, I just called it that, right? My part of this, I just called it a problem. Have you got a problem now? Well, yeah. I just called it that. But that's Dharma, right? You don't realize that, okay, if I'm calling this a problem, now it's appearing to my mind as a problem, oh, I have to work with it, won't I? I wish to put an end to that problem, I'm going to have to start thinking about this. Because if I just leave it there like that, I've got a problem. It's not going to go away. Is it workable? Heck yeah. It's mentally constructed. Verbally and mentally constructed. Because if I call it something else, like, oh, what is the
opportunity?
What's the opportunity here?
But what's the difference between that and just using thought transformation like an entrepreneur in business to go?
There's no difference because the refuge is mind. You don't rely on your mind. I mean, you can't not rely upon your mind. That's the thing. You can. It's only going to create a problem for you. That's suffering, called suffering. Well, it's going to provide a solution for you, what we call happiness. But you don't have to know, that's up to us, right? We have to do it. Because if you think it's a problem that somebody else has to solve, well, you've got a problem until somebody else solves it for you. So you have deep confidence in the nature of your mind, that you have a mind, a refuge. Westerners should understand that refuge is, what's that mean, she say? A state of mind. You should have deep confidence in that. Whatever happens is a state of mind. If it's a state of mind, it's impermanent. It lacks self. It's empty. In fact, if I looked at any object of my mind to find it, I can't find it. I can actually try that out and see if it's true. And you will find out it's true. There's nothing there. It's all workable. So, you know, try it on. Try it on. Ben.
I don't know if this is a measure of how much I'm not working, but yesterday someone almost ran me over.
I'm sorry? Yesterday?
Yesterday someone almost ran me over.
Yeah.
And my reflex gave me the finger.
Yeah.
I thought, oh, anger.
Yeah, yeah.
And I thought, like, you know, 12 years ago, it would have probably started on. I would have just been raging and, like, you know,
I just reflexed
it because it was just a
look. Yeah, that's right.
I just noticed in my mind
didn't
feel any anger.
That's right, there's no mental stuff going on,
there's just
the body going.
Actually, road rage or the diminishing of road rage as a measure of having gone for refuge is a really good litmus test because it's something that we notice a difference in our mind.
Yeah.
It's really, it comes really
apparent. You can still say the words of, like, you just can't put it. You don't feel any anger, or you don't feel any animosity, it's just a habit.
is if you apply these methods, you'll find you change. It's just obvious, well, what's not obvious is how much you've changed until something, you know, gets in your face. And you find out, well, even perhaps you're not angry. I mean, and that's really the purpose of going on retreat, right? To work specifically on different things with the mind. So what's our takeaway? Well, with these 12 questions, we've answered them all. Like I said, and the hardest bit for all of this, I would imagine, is going and saying, how do I distinguish the Buddha jewel from the Sangha jewel and the Dharma jewel? What's the difference between the Buddha jewel? And so the Buddha jewel is the teacher of refuge, the teacher. But then what's this Dharma jewel then?
Truth.
Yeah. Well, what's this? You know, so that takes a little bit of time. But like I said, we've got time, and that's the whole point of working in these classes. So not just to hear it and listen and then you come back, which you probably will, 3 years later and go, oh yeah, I heard that. You know, I didn't tell my son what it meant to take refuge in the Buddha meant. Because if I did, I'd know myself. And there's four answers in this sample assessment. So we've come to the end of our class for tonight, folks, and this was just the review. So again, there are these refuge meditations up online, there's like 7 or 8 of them. Reviewing of the past material, Miffy's going to put up the PDFs, so you can look at that and go, so what do I know? What can I just say off the top of my head? If you can do that, you have a good understanding of what refuge is, and then go, and what am I very poor at here? And you're probably going, very poor at taking these 7 parts of Buddha, Dharma and Sangha and saying what each one of them is and why they're different and what you're doing. Yeah, yep, okay. So then I just got to learn that. How do I do that? Well, that's entirely up to you. Find the easiest one. You know, might find, well, what distinguishes Buddha from Dharma from Sangha? Well, what's their main characteristic? What's the main characteristic of the Buddha? What's the main characteristic of Dharma, Sangha and so forth? And don't do a whole lot, but just do like one at a time, you know, and just hold that for the day. At the end of the week, you've got them all. Now, I've got a refuge ceremony coming up.
This Sunday.
Oh, my God.
In a few days.
In a few days, we'd be saying.
So yeah. If you're coming, please RSVP, especially if this is the first time taking refuge, so that we can prepare.
Yeah. And then the class afterwards will be from afflictions to perfections.
Yeah, so...
For those of you online, thank you for being here. And for those of you in my class, great that you're here. So we've created some merit here. This merit has dependently arisen through you being here, listening. Therefore, it's empty of any intrinsic nature. So we're going to dedicate this dependently arisen merit towards a dependently arisen goal of Buddhahood for the sake of all beings. So due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the Supreme Jewel, Bodhicitta, not yet born, arise tomorrow. May that born have no decline but increase forevermore. And as long as space endures and as long as sentient beings abide, may I too remain to dispel the sorrows of the world.